This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Lake Silence, The World of the Others by Anne Bishop. Read for you by Alexandra Harris. In memory of Mike Briggs and Emma Lee, You Are Missed, January 2017. Chapter 1. Vicky. Moonsday, June 12th. I wouldn't have known about the dead man if I hadn't walked into the kitchen at the exact moment my one and only lodger was about to warm up an eyeball in the wave cooker. Until that moment, I hadn't known I had a scream that could crack glass. I hadn't wondered if an eyeball would puff up and explode in a wave cooker like those animal-shaped marshmallows. And I hadn't realized my lodger, Agatha, call me Aggie, Crow, was that kind of crow. She seemed so normal, if you overlooked her timely payment of the rent each week, and the fact that she had taken up residence in the jumble 3 weeks ago and seemed to be enjoying herself. You can't eat that! I tried to sound firm, like a responsible human and business owner should. In truth, I sounded a wee bit hysterical, and I wished with all sincerity that I had walked into the kitchen 5 minutes later. Then again, since the kitchen was one of the common rooms in the main building, I could have walked in when Aggie was halfway through her lunch, which I'm sure would have been more distressing for at least one of us. Why can't I eat it? She looked at the eyeball rolling around in the small bowl that was now sitting on the counter. Nobody else wants it. It's starting to get squishy, and the dead man doesn't need it. The words got me past the physical evidence. What dead man? The one who doesn't need the eyeball. Little black feathers suddenly sprouted at her hairline, confirming the nature of my lodger. I was going to have to rework the rental agreement so that there was a space for unimportant bits of information like, oh, save species. Where did you find the dead man? On the farm track that runs alongside Crabby Man's place. I should have pointed out that Mr. Milford wasn't usually crabby, but he did get exercised when someone took one bite out of all the ripe strawberries or pinched fruit from his trees, since he and his wife needed the income they made from selling fresh fruit and homemade preserves. But there were other priorities. Show me. I held up a hand. Wait, and don't nibble.
But...
You can't eat it. It could be evidence. Her dark eyes filled with reproach. If I hadn't wanted to warm it up because it was squishy, you wouldn't have known about the dead man, and I could have had eyeball for lunch. I couldn't refute that statement, so I backed up until I reached the wall phone in the kitchen, and then I dialed the emergency number for the Bristol Police Station. Bristol was a human town, located at the southern end of Crystal Lake. Sproing, the only human village near Lake Silence, was currently without its own police force. So Bristol had drawn the short straw and had to respond to any of our calls for help.
Bristol Police Station, what's your emergency?
This is Victoria Devine at the Jumble in Sproing. One of my lodgers found a dead man. Okay, Aggie was my only lodger, but there was no reason to advertise that, right? I started counting and reached 7 before the dispatcher said,
Did you see the body?
No, but my lodger did.
How do you know the body is dead?
I'm looking at an eyeball that used to be attached to the body. This time, I counted to 8.
We'll send someone.
The words were slow in coming, but at least they were said and would be officially noted somewhere. I didn't blame the dispatcher for hesitating to send someone to Sproing. After all, the police officer we'd had before last year's great predation had been eaten, and a couple of officers who had answered calls since then had provoked something in the wild country and never made it back to their station. But I resented that I could feel her blaming me for whatever the police were going to find. On the other hand, I did withhold one tiny bit of information. Just wait until the responding officer realized he had to interview one of the Terra Indigene. A bit of useful information. My name is Victoria. Call me Vicky Devine. I used to be Mrs. Yorick Dane, but giving up my married name was one of the conditions of my receiving valuable property, aka the jumble, as part of the divorce settlement. Apparently, the second official, Mrs. Dane, didn't like the idea that someone else had had the name first. Fortunately, she didn't seem as possessive about York's vigorous appendage. I could have told her that a couple dozen other women had had it before she took possession. But it wasn't likely that she would keep solo possession of the appendage for long. So let her figure things out the hard way like I did. Of course, if she had been one of those indulgences, then she already knew the signs and might be able to nip them in the bud. Maybe that's why, before I had moved away from Hubney, I had seen her in the garden center buying long-handled loppers, the kind used to prune branches, when I'd heard her loudly proclaiming the previous week that gardening was a hobby for women who couldn't do anything else and so not of interest to her. Anyway, I was married to York Dane, an entrepreneur, a.k.a. Wheeler Dealer, although I never understood what sort of deals were wheeled. He said I didn't have a head for business. I finally said I didn't have a head for cheating of any kind. Suddenly, after a decade of marriage, he said I wasn't living up to the promises that were implied by my name, meaning I wasn't hot or in any way sexy. The fact that it took him a decade to realize I was 5'4" and plump instead of a 5'10" pole dancer with big tits was confusing. But once he made that discovery, he decided that he needed someone who would stand by him, and that would not be me. So that's how I came to be the owner of the jumble. According to the story that was muttered by York's family once they'd had a little too much to drink, the jumble was conceived and built by York's great-great-aunt, Honoria Dane, a woman who was equal parts visionary and eccentric. She and her brothers were given equal shares in their father's fortune, the shares being dispersed upon the child's 25th birthday. Great-great, I never heard anyone refer to her by her given name, had sunk her part of the fortune into building the jumble. It was supposed to be a self-sufficient and self-supporting community. It began its genteel decline almost from the moment Great-Great finished building it. The jumble consisted of the sprawling two-story main house, which had a small but fully equipped apartment for the owner, as well as two suites with private bathrooms for guests. It also had a big communal kitchen, a dining room, a library, a social room, an office for the owner, several empty rooms whose use I couldn't identify, and a large shower area off the kitchen that could accommodate up to 4 people at a time as long as they weren't shy. Besides the main house, there were 4 sets of cabins, 3 connected cabins to a set, within easy walking distance from the main building. Each cabin was similar to an efficiency apartment with an open floor plan, no walls or doors for anything but the bathroom. Well, the 3 lakeside cabins that were closest to the main building had ensuite bathrooms. The other 9 cabins were a bit more primitive and an ongoing project. There were acres of land that could be used by the beings in residence. Plenty of room for growing food or raising a goat or two for whatever reason one keeps goats. There was even a chicken coop, sans chickens. It was probably sans a few other things, but if the chickens couldn't pay rent, I couldn't afford to update their lodgings. But the jumble had one thing the village of Sproing did not. It included easy access to Lake Silence, which was an afterthought body of water compared to the other Finger Lakes. There was a public beach at the southern end of the lake, but I thought the jumble's private beach and dock were a lot nicer. Whoever negotiated the original lease agreement for the use of the land knew every devious loophole a person might try to use to rezone, repurpose, re-something the land. But the terms were brutally simple. It was the jumble, with its set number of buildings of a particular size and so many acres of cultivated land, being a modest percentage of the overall acreage, or nothing. The Dane inheritance was actually the buildings and their contents. The land could be used only within the terms of the lease. Last bit of information. Sproing is a human village with a population of less than 300. Like most, if not all, of the villages in the Finger Lakes area, it is not human-controlled. Sure, we have an elected mayor and village council, and we pay taxes for garbage pickup and road maintenance and things like that. The main difference is this. On the continent of Thasia, a human-controlled town is a defined piece of land with boundaries, and humans can do anything they want within those boundaries. But villages like Sproing don't have a boundary, don't have that distance from the Terra Indigene. The Earth Natives. The others. The dominant predators that control most of the land throughout the world and all of the water. When a place has no boundaries, you never really know what's out there watching you. The surprising thing is, there hadn't been a reported interaction with one of the others in decades. At least around Sproing. Maybe the others have been coming in and buying Come Sproing With Me or I Heart Sproingers t-shirts without anyone realizing it. But even though the village lost about a quarter of its residents because of last summer's great predation, everyone still wanted to believe that the others were out there and didn't find us interesting enough or bothersome enough to hunt down and have as snacks. Which made me wonder if the others came into town seasonally, like tourists. And that made me wonder if everyone had missed the obvious when stores ran out of condiments like ketchup and hot sauce some weekends. And whether a run on ketchup and hot sauce coincided with people disappearing. Something to ask Aggie once we got past the whole eyeball thing. Chapter 2. Grimshaw. Moonsday, June 12th. Officer Wayne Grimshaw drove toward the village of Sproing, the cruiser's flashing lights a warning to anyone else on the road that he was responding to a call and was all business. But the siren remained silent because that sound would have drawn the attention of everything for miles around. And when a man was in the wild country, even on a paved road that was a vaguely acknowledged right-of-way, it was better not to alert the Earth Natives to his presence. Dead body reported at the jumble near Sproing. Sproing. By all the laughing gods, what kind of name was that for a village? It sounded like some kind of initiation or razzing. Have the new guy respond to a call and then have to keep asking for directions to Sproing. Plenty of off-color jokes could be made about that. Except he knew the name wasn't a joke. He had seen it on the map at the Bristol station and had been told calls from citizens living around Lake Silence were part of Bristol's jurisdiction. Added to that, the emergency dispatcher, who was a no-nonsense woman, had sounded reluctant to send him. And he'd been advised a couple of times by other officers at the station that if he had to answer a call around Lake Silence, he should get in and out as quickly as possible, because things around that particular lake were a wee bit hinky. The village had a small police station, but no longer had its own police force. Not a single cop patrolling its streets. The people there were dependent on the highway patrol that worked out of the Bristol station. And even then, over the past few months, two officers who had answered calls around Sproing hadn't returned. One officer was found in his patrol car, which had been crushed by something powerful enough to flatten a car with its fists or paws or some freaking appendage. The other man, most of that officer had been found, but no one knew what had set off the attack or why it had been so vicious. Both deaths were harsh reminders that the highway patrol traveled through the wild country as part of the job, and a man never knew what was watching him when he stepped out of his vehicle. Grimshaw had been patrolling the secondary road south of Bristol, a loop that would have taken him close to Lake Silence anyway. So when he spotted a sign for the lake, he turned onto the dirt road, hoping it would take him to the jumble, which he'd been told was some kind of resort right on the lake. Instead, he found himself in the parking area for the lake's public beach. From what he had gathered from his captain's orientation speech, the land on the western side of Lake Silence was privately owned, or at least privately controlled, as was most of the eastern side. There was no vehicle access to the northern end of the lake, which left only the southern end for anyone who wanted to take a cool dip on a hot day, or take a boat out for fishing or recreation. Grimshaw frowned at the two signs attached to the low stone wall that separated the parking area from the beach. The first sign read, "Pack out your trash or else." The second sign read, "You may swim, fish, sail, row, canoe, or float on rafts at your own risk. If you put a motor in the water, you will die." Nothing ambiguous about either message. Grimshaw turned the cruiser around and got back on the main road, heading north. The next turnoff had a weathered sign for the jumble. He made the turn and followed the gravel access road up to the main building. As he shut off the car, he pressed two fingers against his chest and felt the round gold medal for Mikos, the guardian spirit of police officers, firemen, and medical personnel. A talisman he had worn under his uniform every day since he graduated from the police academy a decade ago.
"Mikos, keep me safe."
It was the prayer he whispered every time he answered a call. A woman stepped into view, looking agitated. Curly brown hair, a pleasant enough face, and a build he would describe as stocky if she had been a man. He couldn't tell more than that from this distance, so Officer Wayne Grimshaw got out of the cruiser and went to see Miss Victoria Devine about a body. Chapter 3. Vicky. Moonsday, June 12th.
"But I can't,"
Aggie wailed, sprouting more feathers when I told her she would have to talk to the police. The additional black feathers in her hair were less distressing than the ones that suddenly appeared on her face and forearms. "You have to," I replied, striving to remain calm. I placed a saucer over the bowl with the eyeball. "You're the only one who knows where to find the body. You'll need to show the police when they get here."
"But I'll get in trouble."
My breath caught and my heart thudded. Aggie was petite and had a small boned physique, and my purse probably weighed more than she did. But being one of those crows, she could be a lot stronger than she looked. "Aggie, you didn't..." What would I do if she admitted that she had killed a man in order to eat his eyeball? I imagined myself being strong and brave and performing some kick-ass self-defense moves despite not actually knowing how to do them. Then I imagined myself smiling weakly right before I ran away. I liked the idea of running away. Much more sensible.
"I didn't kill him."
Aggie sounded insulted.
"He was already dead when I found him and only had one eyeball."
"What happened to the other one?"
"Dunno. Probably got eaten."
Since I liked Aggie, I really didn't want to ask more questions. I grabbed the bowl with the eyeball and went outside to wait for the police. Aggie followed me out the front door, but started edging toward the trees. "Aggie?" Hearing tires on gravel, I turned to watch the police car as it drove up within sight of the house and stopped at a spot that blocked the access road. When I turned back, a pile of clothes lay under a tree, and Aggie was gone. So I stood there, alone, holding the bowl while I waited for the police officer to get out of the car. You know those cartoon heroes with the strong lower jaws, sparkly teeth, broad shoulders, and tiny waists? The man who stepped out of the police car could have been the model for the caricature, but he was correctly proportioned and looked really official with all the doodads on his belt. He was wearing sunglasses, so I couldn't see his eyes. Couldn't tell if the expression in them was a warm, "Can I help you, ma'am?" or a cold, "You're being a pain in my ass, so talk fast." If he had stopped to help when I was stranded on a dark, lonely road, I would have been happy to see him. But that presence was less reassuring when I wasn't sure I wouldn't be labeled the villain.
"Are you the lady who called about a suspicious death?"
he asked, approaching warily. He was a big man and had a big voice. Not that he was yelling at me or anything, but it was the kind of voice that could hammer a person. The kind of voice that, when used with a threatening tone, could trigger a panic attack. He stopped and studied the claw marks on a tree. Marks that were high enough that I hadn't noticed them because they weren't in my usual line of sight. Something to think about on a hot summer night when I'm trying to convince myself that it's safe to leave the windows open to get some air. Safe from thieves, maybe, since I have nothing to steal. Safe from the mysterious claw man? I'd read somewhere that an ordinary bear could hook its claws in a car door and rip the door off the hinges in order to get to the snack someone foolishly left inside. Odds were good that whatever prowled around in the Jumbles woods didn't qualify as ordinary. Although, to be fair, Aggie was the only Terra Indigene I had seen. Seen being the qualifying word. If one of the crows hanging around the Jumble was Crowguard, how many others were more than they seemed? My lodger found a body near the farm track that is the boundary between my property and the Milfords' orchards, I replied, trying for matter-of-fact helpful. I held out the bowl. Here, this is evidence. He took the bowl, lifted the saucer, and stared at the eyeball. At least, I assumed he stared at the eyeball, since he was wearing those mirrored sunglasses. He could have been staring at me, and it suddenly occurred to me that if he asked to look in my refrigerator, I had no idea what he might find.
Wait there.
He walked back to his car and opened the trunk. He returned in a minute without the eyeball. It didn't look like he was going to return my bowl and saucer either.
I'll need to speak to your lodger.
She's a little shy about talking to the police. He removed the sunglasses. The look in his blue-gray eyes said my lodger better get unshy in a hurry. Or maybe I was projecting from past experience with men. Man. The one who used to leave me feeling that something was my fault, even when I couldn't have controlled someone else's actions or thoughts or opinions.
Did she tell you the location? Can you show me the alleged body?
I had just given him an eyeball. How alleged could the body be? I looked at the crow, or crow, perched in a tree a couple of yards down one of the bridle paths, of which the Jumble has many. Yes, I can. I set off down the path and hoped really hard that I was following Aggie and not someone else. The second time I tripped and would have landed face first in the dirt if the officer hadn't grabbed my arm and kept me upright, he grumbled.
You might do better watching where you're walking than looking at the trees.
Sound advice. I wished I could take it. But I didn't want to explain that our guide was in the trees, because that would require explaining the nature of our guide.
Stop,
he said, after we had been walking a while. It felt like forever. And since I hadn't gone back inside the house to get my wristwatch before we headed out, time was measured by how it felt.
Do you have any idea where you're going?
Of course I do, officer. I realized he hadn't told me his name. Maybe that wasn't required?
Grimshaw.
Really? So not the correct response, especially from someone named Vicky Devine. The Milford's place is the land between the Jumble and the road that leads to Sproing. The body was found near the farm track between the Milfords' land and mine.
So we should be heading east.
I was about to agree, but the affirmative words stuck in my throat. Were we supposed to be heading east? Was this a trick question? Couldn't be heading west. The lake was to the west of the main house. Could, in fact, be seen from the back of the main house. But that left two other directions unaccounted for.
Miss Devine?
Officer Grimshaw was not a happy camper. I breathed a sigh of relief. This way. Suddenly, there were three crows on the same branch, making me think of the shell game where you have to figure out which shell is hiding the pea. Three black birds were sitting in a tree. Which one was A-G-G-I-E? Only one took off, so I followed, hoping it was a crow, and Officer Grimshaw followed me. Big mistake. I probably should have admitted to being geographically challenged before I let him into the woods.
Ah!
Open ground. Daylight. The dirt road, aka the farm track. And the body.
Ew!
That wasn't a professional response. But I wasn't a professional, and I sincerely hoped I never met this man again. Either man.
Stay there,
Grimshaw said, as he moved closer to the body. Like I was going to get closer when my knees already felt rubbery and my stomach felt swoopy.
This body has been disturbed.
I'd be disturbed too if I was suddenly dead, I replied. He twisted around enough to look at me and must have decided I wasn't trying to be a smartass. I just wasn't quite in control of what I was saying anymore. Since I had dealt with the eyeball pretty well, the only explanation was that my brain had decided that, with someone else here to handle the problem, it no longer had to be fully functional during this stage of the crisis, and could enjoy a mini-anxiety attack.
Not a lot of predation,
Grimshaw said, studying the body.
I don't think he's been here long.
Aggie said his eyeball was squishy. That's why she wanted to warm it up in the wave cooker. Wouldn't it take a while for the eyeball to get squishy? I watched him put his sunglasses back on before he turned to face me.
Aggie is your lodger?
Arctic voice. I nodded, glad I couldn't see his eyes because my insides were quivering as I braced for Arctic voice to become hammer voice.
I really need to talk to her.
My quivering insides translated his officially polite voice as more encouraging than scary, so I pointed at the branch above me. Go ahead. His head moved, so I assumed he was looking up. Then, as he turned away, I heard him say,
Crap.
It wasn't so much spoken as a breath shaped into sound. Aggie lifted her wings in what might have been an apologetic shrug and let out a timid,
Caw.
Grimshaw pulled out his mobile phone and made a call. The next couple of minutes sounded like a TV show with all the officer needs assistance and requests for the medical examiner and transport of the remains. He hadn't gotten very far into explaining the situation when 7 birds winged toward the body. They landed close and moved closer, despite Grimshaw waving an arm to keep them away. Friends of yours? I asked, looking up at Aggie.
Caw!
Officer,
I heard.
Yeah, regular crows would have been enough of a problem if you wanted to avoid having more body bits and pieces being taken away for someone's dinner. But dealing with the crow guard? That made this a potential PR fiasco for the police department, and every other human service that could be affected by the Terra Indigenes taking exception to someone keeping them away from the buffet. Or was it the body that was so intriguing? I saw a glint of gold. A wristwatch. It looked like someone had been trying to pull it off and had been interrupted. By our arrival?
I have to stay with the body until the crime investigation unit gets here,
Grimshaw said.
Can you find your way back to the house?
Sure.
Can you find your way back?
Could we call that a no-confidence vote for the geographically challenged?
Caw!
At least Aggie was confident of getting us back to the main house. So there, Officer Smarty Pants. I headed back up the path, fairly sure that I could get out of sight before getting lost.
Ms. Devine?
Grimshaw's voice stopped me, but I didn't turn around. Yes, officer?
I'll still need to talk to you and your lodger. Don't go anywhere.
Like I could with his big official vehicle blocking the access road that led up to the main house. Somehow, I couldn't see myself taking off on my bicycle in order to escape the law. Besides, all I did was report finding a body. How much trouble could I get into for doing that? Chapter 4. Them. Moonsday, June 12th. He studied the 3 men he had summoned for this late-night meeting. 2 of them were top-tier members of the club, men who knew how to put together a deal and hold it together until it paid off. They were friends of long-standing, and he had worked with them on several highly successful and lucrative projects. The third man came from money and a solid family name, but he was a third-rate schemer who thought he was a big shot and could talk a good enough game to make other people believe he was as good as he believed himself to be, at least until a person started looking at the actual deals he'd made. Then it became clear that his success depended on his being the big fish in a very small pond. Normally, a man like that wouldn't be included in a deal this size. But the fool was the one who held the papers for the asset they wanted, an asset the man's family hadn't bothered to utilize for decades. Except the damn fool didn't hold the papers anymore. A detail he had forgotten to mention until the other men had shaken on the deal and couldn't exclude him without staining their reputations with the rest of the members of the club. But that forgotten detail was the reason they were looking at trouble now.
"Franklin Cartwright is dead," he said, his voice full of harsh anger. "Murdered?" the fool asked, sounding hopeful. "Killed. My sources have confirmed nothing human could have done it."
"Did Cartwright get the papers we need before getting killed?"
the oldest man asked. He had gray hair and a hefty build and was a decade older than the rest of the men involved in this deal.
"No, but another source is going to make sure those papers aren't available to anyone who might need them."
The oldest man nodded.
"If the bitch can't prove she owns the asset,
it'll give us time."
He studied the fool.
"Why did you ask if Cartwright was murdered? Do you think your lump of an ex-wife could do that?"
"Nah."
The fool waved a hand as if erasing the words.
"She's a dish rag. Just raise your voice and she'll do whatever she's told."
He looked at the two men he considered friends.
"A murder charge won't stick, but I'll call one of our associates who is on the scene. Let's see if he can push the dish rag's buttons and convince her that she'll be held responsible for Cartwright's death."
Everyone thought that was a splendid idea. Since he knew the fool would go home and bleat the details of this secret meeting to the new wife, he didn't say anything more about their plans, even though the new wife happened to be his cousin. And he waited until he was sure the other men had left the building before calling the associates currently located in Sproing. Chapter 5. Grimshaw. Sunday, June 13th. The following morning, Grimshaw parked the cruiser in front of Sproing's police station and studied the building. The exterior looked more like a store that hadn't quite gone out of business, but wasn't being cared for properly because the owner had given up on turning a profit. Considering this was his new assignment, that did not bode well for him because it could be a visual opinion of the last police officer who had manned the station.
"It's a temporary reassignment," Captain Hargreaves had said. "I don't work and play well with others. That's why I work highway patrol," Grimshaw had growled. "Why can't the town boys from the CIU team talk to the villagers? It's their investigation now. Let one of their own park behind the desk in Sproing."
Silence. He'd been working at the Bristol station under Hargreaves for only a couple of weeks, but he'd already learned to be wary of that weighty silence. "There's something damn strange about the CIU team from Putney jumping on this case when it should be outside their jurisdiction," Hargreaves finally said. "So I want someone in the village who reports to me and can handle the day-to-day business during this investigation. And I've decided that someone is going to be you." After a moment, he added, "We need to be careful. Can't afford to step on any toes. Town boys don't always appreciate that when they come into a small place like Sproing." In other words, despite all the evidence over the past year of how the Terra Indigene respond to things they don't like, the CIU team might want to treat this investigation as if they were dealing strictly with other humans. So there he was, the temporary officer in charge of the police station in Sproing, while the Putney CIU team looked into the suspicious death of Franklin Cartwright, if the business cards he'd found near the body actually belonged to the victim. Captain Hargreaves had told him the station would be unlocked, and if it wasn't, he should check with the mayor or with the tenants who had offices on the second floor. The door was unlocked, so Grimshaw went inside to look around, glad he didn't have to talk to anyone yet. Finding a set of keys in the middle drawer of one of the desks, he pocketed them, assuming they had been left for him. He also assumed the landlord, or the holding company that owned the building, had a set for the station as well as the two offices on the second floor. One office was rented by the village's loan attorney. The other? Hargreaves didn't have information on the other tenant. Two desks, one on either side of the room. Two chairs to go with the desks, and a visitor's chair in front of each. Gun cabinet empty of firearms. A cell in the back part of the building. More accurately, a room with a single bed and a rickety bedside table, bars on the window, and a barred cell door, storage room for supplies, and a wall of filing cabinets that actually had files, although nothing current. A bathroom that included a shower cubicle. A small kitchen area that contained an old refrigerator that still worked, and a new coffee maker. If push came to shove, he could bunk at the station until he found temporary lodgings. Grimshaw ran a finger over the desks and was surprised that he didn't swipe away more than a thin layer of dust. Nothing more than what you'd expect just before the weekly cleaning. So the grungy feel was more from age and dingy walls, not a current lack of upkeep. He wasn't sure if that was better or worse. Having seen his new headquarters, he stepped outside. The village hall, which housed the courtroom, as well as the offices for all the municipal services, was on one side of the station. The loan bank was on the other side. Directly across the street from the police station was a store called Let Us Read.
"By hell, the laughing gods,"
Grimshaw muttered as he crossed the street. Was it some kind of produce market? Or something more esoteric and borderline legal? As his foot hit the sidewalk, he saw the sign in the window announcing a sale on used books. It hit him. Let us read. Let us read.
Cute.
He hated cute, and was already predisposed to dislike the frou-frou owner of the place. The wooden door stood wide open. Grimshaw opened the screen door and went in. As his eyes adjusted to the darker interior, he had the unsettling experience of recognizing the man standing behind the information island in the front part of the store.
"Hello, Julian," Grimshaw said. "Hello, Wayne. If you got pulled into this business with the dead body, then I'm sorry for you."
A decade ago, they had been cadets together at one of the Northeast Region's police academies, and had remained friends until Julian disappeared a few years after graduation. But it had only been because of the events of the past year, events that had rocked the whole continent of Thasia, that Grimshaw had pieced together enough information to make some educated guesses about Julian Farrow. Julian had been a brilliant cadet. While he didn't excel to the point of ruining the curve for the rest of them when it came to some of the tests, he had an uncanny ability to sense his surroundings and know when something was off, even when there was no indication of trouble. During the academy drills, he knew when police needed to go down an alley with weapons drawn, and when their mere presence would break up, or calm down, whatever trouble was stirring. Once he was on the force, that ability had saved his fellow officers too many times to count, which was why the incident was more damning than it might have been. Julian had uncovered some bit of naughtiness, probably some kind of corruption within official or police circles. The kind of naughtiness that destroyed careers and came with prison sentences. But no one was really sure, because one night, when he was on the late shift, and his partner had called in sick, Julian responded to a call for assistance. When he arrived, he didn't find the frightened woman who had called the emergency number. He found five men wearing balaclavas waiting for him. Wielding clubs and knives, they jumped him before he could draw his weapon and fire. Or tried to jump him. He hadn't walked far enough into that alley for them to make a thorough job of it. Two of them managed to stab him, and a couple more landed damaging blows with clubs before Julian shook free and ran for his life. Maybe he'd been disoriented. Or maybe his uncanny sense of place, which seemed to have let him down the alley, started working for him again. How else to explain why he turned down another alley, one that ended at a solid wall? He'd scrambled up on the big garbage containers and managed to get over the wall before he blacked out, having lost a lot of blood. That was the testimony he gave. He blacked out and couldn't provide any information about what walked into that alley behind the five men who were chasing him. But something did. Something large enough and powerful enough to eviscerate five men before ripping off their arms, their legs, and their heads. The savagery had shocked the entire police force in the northeast region, to say nothing of causing a panic among the citizens in human towns who had thought they were safe from the Terra Indigene as long as they stayed within town limits. No one could prove Julian hadn't blacked out, that he hadn't heard everything that happened to those men. No one could prove he'd chosen that alley with the intention of trapping those men. No one could prove he was anything but the victim of attempted murder, or assault at the very least, if the men were only supposed to discourage him from further investigations into the naughtiness. No one could prove anything, but everyone on the force who had gone to the academy with him, or had worked with him, knew about his ability, and were certain he hadn't chosen that alley at random, that he'd known in some way that it was his only chance of escape. And no one could prove that he'd sensed what would happen to the men who followed him into that alley. But two of those men were fellow officers, which caused a stink and all kinds of investigations. In the end, Julian was awarded a settlement for his wounds, which were declared grievous enough to end his career as a police officer, and he disappeared. Until now. Grimshaw looked around. Didn't seem to be a thriving business, but that could just be the time of day.
A bookstore?
Have to make a living, Julian replied. I like books.
Like to read. And I know an evasive answer when I hear one. Why here?
Why not? Grimshaw rested both forearms on the island and relaxed. Let's shoot the bull, Stance. After a moment, Julian mirrored his posture, so that, at first glance anyway, they looked like two friends just catching up with the "How's your life been?" news.
Why are you really here? Grimshaw asked. Before you try to bullshit me, let me remind you that I'm not stupid, and we do go back a ways. And there was always something a little hinky about the way you left the force.
You think there was anyone on the force who would want to work with me after the incident? Julian countered.
I would have.
Simple truth. He studied the man who had been his friend.
Why didn't you tell anyone you're an Intuit? That your ability wasn't exclusive to you?
He made it sound like he'd known for a while, instead of waiting now for the answer that would confirm his educated guesses.
And risk exposing my people to discrimination or persecution?
Julian's gray eyes looked as hard as stone.
We'd already been down that road. Already had the experience of how other humans responded to our ability to sense things. That's why our communities are in the wild country, and why we don't admit what we are when there is a need to spend time away from our own. Now that some Intuits have come out of the closet, so to speak, it's been estimated that one out of three human communities in the Finger Lakes area is an Intuit community, or a mix of Intuit and simple life folk, Grimshaw said. Something that still isn't commonly known outside of government and police circles. And which communities are Intuit hasn't been confirmed. And the Finger Lakes, or Feather Lakes as the others call them, are the wild country. There isn't a single human-controlled village on any of these lakes. Being part of the highway patrol, that is a fact you know well.
Yes, he did.
If you had to keep what you are a secret,
Why not attend an Intuit Police Academy in one of your own communities?
There wasn't one.
Not then.
There are a couple of them now in the Northeast region for the men who feel the need to serve and protect.
Grimshaw continued to study the man who had been his friend. Julian's dark hair was long enough to pull back in a tiny tail, but he wore it down so it looked shaggy, or maybe just disheveled in a way that might appeal to some women. A lean build and finely sculpted face with a thin scar across one cheekbone, a souvenir of that attack. Or maybe just the scar that people could see. Grimshaw suspected Julian Farrow had a few other scars from that night that weren't on the skin or visible to the eye. But he'd also been a good cop. Even more than that, he'd been a good investigator. Which left the question, what had Julian Farrow really been doing all these years?
You sure that's all you're doing here in Sproing? Selling books?
Julian looked toward the screen door. Grimshaw thought he heard a quiet scratching on the screen, but when he looked over his shoulder, he didn't see anything.
I have just the thing for an evening read, Julian said. Something I doubt you would have read before.
He walked into the back area of the store and returned a minute later. He placed two books and what looked like a narrow trencher on the counter. Opening a container, he put 10 pieces of carrot on the trencher and walked over to the screen door. He propped open the door with a gallon jug that must have been filled with sand or water, Grimshaw couldn't tell which, from where he was standing, and set the trencher on the floor just inside the threshold. As he walked back to the island, he held up two fingers and said,
"Two pieces for each of you."
Grimshaw stared at the critters who gathered at the door. Five of them. For a moment, he wondered if Julian had gone completely out of his mind to be feeding giant rats. But the faces didn't belong to rats. What could look that happy about a piece of carrot?
Alan Wolfgard writes thrillers, Julian said, when he resumed his place on the other side of the island's counter. And the other is a mystery written by an Intuit writer.
What the fuck?
Grimshaw whispered. Then he caught the warning in Julian's eyes and picked up one of the books.
Never heard of Alan Wolfgard.
But he knew the name meant the author was a Terra Indigene Wolf.
You like his stuff?
I do.
And his perspective on the genre is different. I'll bet.
And something you may find useful, Julian whispered.
Hearing a scraping at the door, Grimshaw looked back to see the five, whatever they were, push the wooden tray to one side of the door. Then they made that happy face and hopped away. Not like a rabbit or anything else he'd ever seen.
Those are Sproingers, from which this village takes its name, Julian said.
But what are they?
That's a question. I've collected books about places all my life, especially books that have photographs of wildlife and plants from other parts of this continent, as well as other parts of the world. My best guess is the template for the critters we know as Sproingers came from the continent of Australis.
That's so far away, it might as well be another world, Grimshaw protested.
How many weeks on a ship would it take to reach such a place?
How could a critter from...
Then what Julian had said hit him.
The template? Among the odd things about Sproingers, besides the fact that they're here at all, is that there are always about 100 of them, and on this continent they can only be found around Lake Silence, Julian said. They have no natural enemies. They're big enough to take on any domestic cat, and dogs back away from them. But there are never more than 100. There are bobcats who live in the woods, as well as coyotes, both ordinary animals in Terra Indigene. Nothing touches the Sproingers. So they're a bit of a tourist attraction with their happy little faces and the way they hop around and stop at various stores for treats. And while they stuff their faces, they listen to everything that's going on around them.
But they're not predators, Grimshaw said.
There has never been a known form of Terra Indigene that wasn't a predator. The Terra Indigene, the Earth natives, the others, were, as a group, the dominant predators throughout the world. And they could be a terrifyingly efficient killing force, as humans had learned last summer.
That's true, Julian agreed. Sproingers aren't predators.
I doubt the same could be said about their other form.
Do you know what that is?
Something dangerous. Julian hesitated.
Did you wonder about the name of the store? I thought some frou-frou idiot owned the place.
Julian laughed softly.
I opened the store last fall.
After the Terra Indigene swept through Thasia last summer and killed so many humans during the Great Predation, a lot of stores in Sproing were suddenly without owners.
Either because the owners died, or the people packed up and ran. The bookstore, such as it was at the time, was one of those places.
The owner's heirs wanted to sell fast and get to any place that was human-controlled. I bought it. It was around dusk one day before I officially opened, and someone stepped into the store. She looked small enough to be a child, but she never came all the way into the store, and the light was such that I couldn't see her clearly. She asked if I was going to open the story place, and I said I was. She asked what the name would be, and I told her I hadn't decided yet, and maybe she could help me pick a name. I didn't think anything of it, just a curious child. But 2 days later, she walked into the store at dusk and placed a scrap of paper on the counter with two words carefully printed out. Lettuce, read.
Let us read. She chose words that sounded correct.
Julian nodded.
Either she didn't know better, or she was testing me. Either way, that's how the store got its name. Now five of her kind come to the store once a week at dusk. In fading light, you could mistake them for human. They have the right shape, mostly. But they're not human. I'm not sure what kind of Terra Indigene they are. But I am sure they're predators of the highest order, and they live somewhere around this lake. They come in, and each of them buys one book. Sometimes they return a book for a used book credit, and tell me why they didn't like it. Other books they like a lot, so I suggest other stories that might appeal to them. Grimshaw thought about that. Five Sproingers come for carrots every day?
Most every day. They don't show up on Earth Day when the store is closed. But I don't think my book buyers and the Sproingers are the same beings. Although it's possible that one kind of Terra Indigene has chosen to take two very different forms in order to keep an eye on things around this part of the Northeast. Julian looked at Grimshaw for a long moment.
Wayne, something is going on in Sproing. You should be careful about who you choose as allies.
A shiver went down Grimshaw's spine. No idle warning. Not when it came from Julian Farrow.
What do you know about Victoria Devine?
Julian thought for a moment. Too long a moment?
She's a nice woman, Julian finally said. Smart, with a sassy sense of humor. She doesn't hurt other people's feelings in order to be funny. The jumble was part of her divorce settlement, along with a cash payment. She sunk the cash into the property, which needed repairs as well as new windows, new wiring, plumbing, septic tank. You name it, the place needed it. She managed to fix up the main house and three of the guest cabins.
Now it's a game of wait and see if she can get enough guests on a regular basis to be able to keep the place going.
I haven't witnessed one, but I gather she's experienced mild anxiety attacks since her separation and divorce. But for the most part has handled the challenge of living in an isolated spot like the jumble. As far as having paying guests, she has a prime beach, which is available only to her guests. Something some of the villagers resent because it's bigger than the public beach area at the southern end of the lake. I guess people got used to using the jumble's beach as if it was public land and don't like it being off limits.
You like her?
Julian gave Grimshaw a sharp look.
I usually like people I call friends.
That's why they're friends.
Have you asked her out?
She wasn't his type. Too nervy, for one thing. But Julian had always had his own rules when it came to relationships.
What are you, the dating police?
Julian demanded. He grinned.
Just asking.
Julian looked away, making Grimshaw wonder about scars you couldn't see, and wonder if he'd just scraped across one of those scars.
Julian?
My impression is that Vicky Devine had a train wreck of a marriage and a car wreck of a divorce, and there are some deep wounds that haven't healed yet. Grimshaw thought about her reaction to him, the way she had flinched a couple of times, as if expecting a blow of some kind.
She has trouble being around men.
Owning a resort was a bad choice of profession if that was the case.
Friends are fine. I didn't hear of her having problems with any of the contractors who did work at the jumble.
But when it gets too personal, the anxiety attack that follows can't be described as mild. Julian hesitated. Vicky boarded with Inike Xavier while the jumble was being restored. One night, one of the other guests tried some moves. I don't know any details except Inike kicked the man to the curb and called the doctor to deal with Vicky's reaction.
Crap,
Grimshaw said softly. Nervy didn't begin to describe someone like that.
We meet up for lunch sometimes, or go to a movie with other friends.
As long as no one calls it a date, with whatever physical demands that word conjures up for her, she's fine.
And you're okay with that?
She's my friend. I'm okay with that. Julian blew out a breath. There was a rumor that the dead man was connected to a developer who was going to build a significant lakeside resort. An abrupt change of subject. Grimshaw took the hint.
You figure someone is looking at the jumble for that?
That's the only land available. And it isn't really available.
Unless a dead body shows up on the property, and the investigation scares off the current owner.
He thought for a moment.
What about the other side of the lake? Could someone be looking at that?
Julian huffed out a laugh.
Silence Lodge is the home of the local group of Sanguinati. No one with brains or any desire to live would approach the vampires about developing land around the lake. What if I needed to talk to one of them?
Call your landlords. I believe they have the other office above the police station.
Crap, Grimshaw said. How many buildings do the Sanguinati own in this village?
More than the mayor or anyone else realizes. But that's just a guess. Too much to think about, and he needed some time and quiet to think.
Any place around here to stay?
Didn't see an inn or motel. Inike Xavier's boarding house, if you're looking for short term. It's clean and the food is good. She can be a bit difficult at times, but it's your best choice. For longer term, there are some cabins along Mill Creek, which has a water mill that generates the electricity for the cabins. Come to think of it, I think it's the source of electricity for the jumble, too. The cabins are basic one-bedroom, but furniture can be included. I'm renting one of them and can't complain.
Who owns the cabins?
But Grimshaw had a feeling he already knew.
The residents of Silence Lodge.
Don't let paved streets and storefronts fool you, Wayne. This is the wild country, and all of us are prey. A lot to think about.
I guess I better go over to the boarding house and see if Miss Xavier has room to rent.
How much do I owe you for the books?
Bring them back in decent shape and I can sell them to Vicky as good used books.
Julian smiled.
She's building up a library for herself and for her potential guests, but she's on a budget.
It was tempting to ask if Julian knew that Victoria Devine's lodger was one of the Crow Guard, but that could wait for another day.
See you around, Julian.
Your business is just across the street from mine, so that's likely. Following Julian's directions, Grimshaw got in his car and drove to the boarding house. Yeah, he had a lot to think about, regardless of what the crime investigation unit uncovered. Like, what was Julian Farrow really doing in a place like Spring?
Chapter 6. Vicky. Sunday, June 13th.
Inike Xavier ran the boarding house in Spring. She was a tall woman, at least compared to me, and wore black framed glasses. What made her stand out was her hair. It was a dark brown that was almost black, streaked with bright burgundy and teal. There had been a lot of rumors flying around Hubnee.